Hello, and welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We release these episodes every week on Wednesday mornings, and the best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you are listening. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via Venmo by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can make a donation through our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, by clicking the Donate tab. Peace and love. Hope you enjoy.
Today we're going to continue our series of talks on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and we're on one of my favorite topics, which is the Third Noble Truth, which is awakening. We're talking about awakening this morning, and the cooling down of reactivity, which is how I choose to define that term, awakening. So awakening is kind of the natural result of the practice. It's the good news of Buddhism. Freedom is possible. Freedom from suffering is possible. But sometimes Buddhism gets a bad rap because we don't start with the good news. The first noble truth, there is suffering. Life can be difficult and stressful and full of dis-ease and dissatisfaction. Well, that comes first, right? So I think maybe one of the reasons why Buddhism doesn't have any evangelists, right? The PR strategy is pretty awful. You can imagine someone coming up to your door when you're eating dinner with your family. It's, hello, sir and ma'am. Have you heard the bad news? Life is suffering. And so it is actually really interesting, as religious traditions go, that there's so much emphasis on suffering, you know, within Buddhism. And for me personally, I can just speak from my own experience. It was really validating to enter into a practice that gave so much attention to the more difficult dimension of life. Because for me, and I know this isn't a blanket generalization of religion, but in the religions that I grew up with, there was a lot of emphasis on this kind of mysterious and otherworldly grace of God that for me seemed to be this thing, this force that somehow balanced the scales of justice that I must seek refuge in to answer problems that I couldn't explain. And not a lot of tools and acknowledgement of suffering and ways to deal with suffering in the here and now, in the present. And that was maybe just my experience. I see some heads nodding, so I think maybe some other people have had similar experiences. You know, I think this says more about humans than it does about religions. You know, is that we seem to be very belief-centric as a way to cope with uncertainty and tragedy and grief and loss. And so for me, when I found the Buddha's teaching, I felt like he sought to normalize and validate the struggle that we were experiencing with the First Noble Truth. You know, have you noticed that it's really hard to be human? And that there's aging and illness and death and separation, and sometimes we get what we want and sometimes we get what we don't want, and that sucks, and that's really hard. And he gave us tools to engage with it. You know, very empowering, the Buddha's teaching. His dying words were, be a light unto yourself, seek no external refuge. Each one of us has to do the work ourselves to confront our suffering and to work through it in this life. And so he removed this emphasis on things outside of ourselves for our salvation. And he empowered our own citta, the heart, the mind, our own potential, our own Buddha nature, whatever you want to call it, capacity for mindfulness, if we want to be scientific about it. Right? But that's inside of you, that the same mind that ruminates and reacts is the same mind that possesses the capacity for mindfulness. You know, the same mind that can be full of hatred and anger and rage is the same mind that has the capacity for compassion and love. And so his first teaching was on the Four Noble Truths after his own awakening. And he jumped right out of the gate with the first noble truth. If we were to pose it as a statement, it would be something like, there is dukkha. And dukkha is the word that we usually leave untranslated. Sometimes people translate it as a suffering, which is kind of heavy-handed. It's maybe more like stressfulness, unsatisfactoriness, dis-ease. So that as a statement, it would be there is, in this life, dis-ease, stress, friction. And he defines it. He says, birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, encountering what is not dear is dukkha, separation from what is dear is dukkha, not getting what one wants is dukkha. Have you noticed that it's hard to be human? This is what we're up against. This is what's given in this lifetime. And I think what the Buddha is saying here is that it's not our fault, right? It is actually something, it's a tie that binds us rather than something that separates us. And this was helpful for me because when I came into Buddhist practice, I was very depressed. Actually, one of my friends is in the room that witnessed me during that time. And it was existential, and it was usually in the flavor of, I'm the only one, and this is permanent. Right? Have you noticed that about depression? That's its favorite story. And so when the Buddha was like, yeah, you're not the only one, and it's totally impermanent, and this is a truth, you know, of our experience together, and it's something that binds us together. It's actually shared. It made me feel less alone. I think that's what it did. But the first thing that we need to do, the contemplation of the first noble truth, because the Buddha never intended these to be doctrines or proclamations of beliefs, of dogmas. They're contemplative practices, right? So even right there in the first sutta, the encouragement is dukkha parinya. Parinya is a verb, so it's something you do. And parinya means to fully know, to turn towards the suffering and to be honest with ourselves when we experience it. And to be willing to be vulnerable enough to be open, not just with others, but to with ourselves first, stepping out of self-deception. Fuck. I'm in a lot of pain. You know, I'm really having a hard time. That kind of, I don't know about y'all, but I have a hard time even getting to that point a lot of the time. Because for me, it's, I'm fine, I'll get through it, I can handle it. If I just get through this quarter, then I'll be okay. Or the holiday, or whatever the next thing is. So the first task of the first noble truth is to be honest with ourselves about the ways that we struggle and we suffer. Carl Jung even says in the field of psychotherapy that we don't awaken by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And I'm going to kind of summarize why this is in the Buddhist philosophy in like a short kind of sentence, but it's easier said than done, right? So we don't awaken by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So somehow by being honest with ourselves about the ways that we struggle and by acknowledging the suffering that we're experiencing, we can actually open to it with curiosity and we can start to investigate what parts of this suffering that I'm experiencing are inarguable, are just the way things are for me right now, and what parts of the suffering are self-created and self-perpetuated. And I always find that in my suffering, there's both. There's the inarguable, the death of a loved one, the physical ailment, the loss of an opportunity. And then there's what the mind is doing with that. There's the story, there's the reactivity, there's the clinging, the craving, and aversion, right? So in order to fully know, in order to find freedom from our suffering, we have to first acknowledge it, turn towards it, and then investigate it. What is inevitable, what is inarguable, and what is optional? So we could say that dukkha parinya means actually not to know dukkha, suffering, stress, difficulty, not to know it intellectually. The word parinya is similar to the way that we might know like a friend. It means intimately through experience. So are we open to our suffering, and are we willing to walk side by side with it? You know, like we would a friend. Not to say, oh, this is dukkha, and the Buddhist checklist says, fully know it. Okay, I know it. Now, is it gone? No, it doesn't go away. We have to be with it. So I like to just think of fully knowing dukkha as actually embracing. Embracing. We stand close and we try to stay open. But that's hard to do, right? So the second noble truth is oftentimes as we start to investigate the difficulty of our lives, we see that there's the inarguable, there's the part that's just kind of woven into the thread of being human, and then there's the reactivity. And the second task is to let go of the reactivity. Within each experience of struggle, each moment of hardship, every challenge, there are usually two arrows, the Buddha says. There's the pain, and then there's the suffering. And this optional layer, we might just call it reactivity. You know, when I talked about the second noble truth a couple weeks ago, the Buddha really defines it pretty clearly as tanha and upadana, which means thirst or craving and clinging. It's a reflexive and reactive grasping onto things to be a different way. And it's just because we don't want to feel pain. We don't want to go through that difficult experience. So the mind reflexively and reactively grasps onto things, trying to make them be a different way. So the second task is to practice letting go of the reactivity. And this isn't easy because it doesn't make the pain go away, you know. It doesn't make the difficulty, you know, turn into something else. It just puts up less of a fight towards it. It's the resistance that causes the suffering. And the third noble truth is with practice, really with the skills that we develop through the cultivation of the Eightfold Path, living in line with our integrity, our values, and then also mindfulness, that we get to experience awakening, moments of ceasing the reactivity or the cooling down. And so I'm going to talk about awakening a little bit, and the first thing that I want to do is demystify it. I think for me, this is just speaking personally, I think we've turned awakening into enlightenment, and we've turned enlightenment into something you need to attain, and we've turned meditation and Buddhism into another field of self-improvement that we can never get to, because the thing that we think it's going to promise is not actually the thing that it promises. Bliss and obliteration of pain and complete, unbounded ecstasy. And if only you were a good enough meditator and followed the rules, then you would get that. And we laugh, and, you know, I laugh too, but I fall into this trap, and I think we all do, is looking towards things to circumvent our suffering. My teacher, my first teacher, Dave, used to always say, Andrew, you just can't outsmart suffering. You go through it. And so the first thing we need to do when talking about awakening is demystify it and remove it from the pedestal or the altar and throw it on the ground. Let it be something that you can actually reach, that you can do. And I find this to be interesting because if you look at the early suttas, when the Buddha talks about awakening, he fumbles through some words, usually through like negation of it's, you know, not this and not that. And sometimes it's easier to describe what something's not than what it is, right? But I feel like the best examples that the Buddha gives of awakening in the teachings is actually in the thing that he calls it, which is nirvana. Hopefully most of us have heard that word before, nirvana. In the Pali, it's the word nibbana, which is a Sanskrit cooking term, which means to remove a boiling pot from a fire. So the way that the Buddha, what he calls awakening, is literally the cooling down of a fire. And the fire is the fire of greed, hatred, and delusion, of reactivity. And being that mindfulness is the tool that we use to cool the fire down, it's something that's entirely within our reach. I want to read a little bit about this type of awareness that we develop in the practice and how that relates to awakening. This is by Ajahn Sucitto. This is a really great book, by the way, Turning the Wheel of Truth. It's all about the Four Noble Truths. He says, the Buddha said his teaching was for those with little dust in their eyes. What is needed then is a recognition that we do have eyes and we can see. They're not just a mass of pathological drives and ignorance, that there is a light that sees the dark for what it is. It shines most clearly not when we're looking for the light, but when we're eager to switch off the dark. We can know and we can have faith in that. We can know that suffering arises. It's a dynamic that we can notice happening. It's not inevitably bound up with the way that you are. We've all had many moments of clarity in our lives. You know, and you could have sat in front of a friend and they could have said, you know, Andrew, you're really fucking up. You need to get your life together. You need to stop drinking so much and isolating. And we probably had those friends and those people tell us these things. But we kind of have our own moments of rude awakening where we come to that realization ourselves, where we see what's getting in our way. And this type of seeing is what we cultivate with mindfulness, present moment awareness, watching, stepping back, seeing the reactivity of the mind, seeing the patterns, the narratives of our thinking mind, the comparing, the judging, the criticizing, the self-loathing. In the early discourses, this is really central in Mahayana Buddhism, but it's also there in the Theravada, in the earliest tradition. The way that the Buddha kind of gave the metaphor for awakening is that we know we can start to investigate what covers up the heart and the mind's natural radiance, that the heart and the mind is already naturally radiant, and we're just seeing the obstructions. And the Buddha calls this nawarana, which means coverings. So he calls greed, hatred, and delusion coverings. And we know this even in psychotherapy, that our defense mechanisms are oftentimes adaptive ways to deal with pain and trauma at times in our lives that may have helped us get through the moment, but are destructive. And so we can see the greed, the hatred, and the delusion as attempts to try to feel safe or to be okay, but ways that ultimately lead against our welfare and our happiness. And simple examples of this have been researched over and over again with like the short-term reward program of our mind, how we often get caught in like simple habits that in the short term feel good and like they help us rest and recover, but actually deplete our dopamine and norepinephrine, our serotonin levels. And then we get so depleted that we become dependent. And then our happiness kind of is inextricably connected to these habits that only once provided short-term results that we end up feeling chained to, and they take the vitality and the beauty out of our lives. And these habits are drug and alcohol addiction, but they're also, you know, my Netflix and my cigarettes and my, you know, whatever it may be. If it's a thing, I've had a habit with it before. You know? So what these things do is they cover up the mind's radiance, and they kind of, dependence creates a box, right? And anytime we lean too heavily on something or some feeling for our happiness is dependent on something else. And the Buddha is saying something quite radical. He's saying that the mind free of grasping for anything else is actually your natural state. If we renounce the grasping after the short term, this and that, he literally says craving is getting caught up or strung out in this and that. You ever feel like you're getting strung out in this and that? And the interesting thing about the Buddha is he's not saying that this particular flavor of this is bad and that particular flavor of that is bad. He's saying it's the relationship. It's that reactive grasping to this and that. A relationship, the drama, the gossip, the, you know, fear, the ecstasy, the whatever it is, you know. And so these things cover up because they create dependence. They pull us in. They suck us into emotionality and reactivity. And then they manifest into behaviors. Then we say the thing we regret and do the thing we regret. But the interesting thing, and the thing I love so much about the Buddha's teaching, is he's trying to follow that back to before the behavior. He's so interested in the mind. What covers up the mind's natural state of radiance and peace? And in the early Buddhist texts, the metaphor the Buddha uses is that the natural state of the mind is like a bowl of water. And these reactive states are like different things obstructing the clarity of the water, like algae or mud, or water that's been whipped by the wind, or water that's been boiling by anger and resentment. So I want to say some things about awakening that I feel like have been true, I feel like are reflected in the Buddha's teaching, to kind of get away from what is it and more into what do we need to cultivate to get it. And the first thing I would say that's pretty clear from the Buddha's teaching is that awakening is a behavior. It's not an experience. There may be many experiences of awakening, but the thing the Buddha emphasizes is the things that you cultivate, the seeds that you plant, the practices that you do that initiate that experience. If you go after the experience, you get in the way of the experience, unfortunately. So you go after the behavior. And a simple way of putting this is, I learned it in 12-step recovery, just do the next right thing. Do your part and let go of the rest. And I hate for things to be this simple, but And my teacher Dave used to say all the time, Andrew, sometimes you plant seeds and sometimes you pick fruit. Because I would be in the middle of a tailspin. You know, that seemed to have lasted for months. And he would say, you know, well, what are you doing today? You got up, you called me, did your meditation practice, you're connecting with your friends. Are you honest? Are you living in your integrity? Are you trying to be kind and compassionate and of service to those people that you meet? And I'm like, yeah, but it's not fucking working fast enough. But I actually find that there's a lot of security in this. There's a lot of safety in the protection of our integrity. Am I doing my part? Am I doing good enough? I won't even say my best. I don't like the whole 110%, you know, because we're not even really good judges of how we're doing a lot of the time. But what am I doing in this moment? How am I showing up in this moment? The Buddha says in the first path factor, which we'll get to in a couple weeks, he says that beings are the owners of their actions, heirs of their actions, spring from their actions, and are bound to their actions. Whatever ways you act, to that you will fall heir. And now I won't get into a discussion of karma because this can be seen in a couple different ways, but the way that's important here is psychologically. Whatever you think and ponder upon becomes the inclination of the mind. Whatever reactive stories you engage with, ruminate in, become more powerful. You know, why does the mind wander when we sit down to meditate? Well, because the attention is addicted to the thinking mind. You didn't tell it to do that. That's just what it does. But we can intervene. We can pull the attention out of the thinking mind and back to the breath. And if you do that enough times, you can watch as the attention gets swept up into the reactive thought. And you can say, no, not right now. And you can bring it out of it. And we've all had many experiences of this, right? If you ever wanted to say something so bad, but you didn't say it, like something you shouldn't say. So awakening is a behavior. We don't need to have a philosophical or theological belief in awakening. We just need to practice living in integrity, living with awareness, living with intention. The other thing the Buddha said very clearly about awakening is that awakening is immediate and available now. He says the Dharma, his teaching. The Dharma also means the way things are. He says the Dharma is clearly visible, immediate, inviting, uplifting, to be personally sensed. The word for this is sanditiko, which means clearly visible. So liberation is available in every moment. And what we do now is the most powerful thing we can focus our attention on. Thich Nhat Hanh says, living in the present moment, we realize that the present is completely made up of the past and completely creating the future. And this makes me feel like an idiot in how much I dwell in the past and obsess about the future. And I always say it because it's just so spot on. Mark Twain said, the worst moments in my life never came true. Right? So many of the things that we obsess about and worry about, what is it good for? It's good for the mental habit of obsession. And if this is your mind, you're not alone, right? This is just what the mind does. But we practice as a behavior showing up in the present in a way that's consistent with our path. What really leads to our welfare and happiness? And it's immediate and available. I've heard it said in the Zen tradition, there's this phrase called sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. And I really love this. It's been incredibly validating for many major moments of change in my life, where all of a sudden I have this kind of gift of desperation where something I've been doing or some way I've been acting just kind of rears its ugly head, and I'm like, I need to change. This sudden moment of awakening where it's like, this needs to change. And then watching myself backslide into similar behaviors or the same behaviors over the course, once you stretch it out like 10 years, you know what I mean, or 20 years. And I actually find that this is the dance of discipline. You know, this is the dance of wisdom, is that we don't get to just learn something once and be done with it. You know, we find ourselves learning the same lessons repeatedly. And that's why being open about our suffering and having the humility is so important, because we will find ourselves covered in the same patterns and behaviors and habits all over again. And how can we give ourselves a break without letting ourselves off the hook? That's the balance. You know, and so I've chosen the best thing for me, probably because of how incessant my self, what's the word, my compulsive self-reliance is I have other people to help hold me accountable. I put myself around people that are gonna model to me ways of living that I find are essential, you know, important. So when I start to backslide, I start to feel that kind of dissonance, because my environment isn't congruent with how I'm living. Y'all, this is what's awesome about being a Dharma teacher, is that you get up here, and if you're full of shit, I get out of here and I'm like, all right, dude, listen to what you just said today, you know? Because there's this constant back and forth, and we need to start to see awakening as gradual. And this is the next part. Yeah, it's immediate and available. We have these moments of sudden awakening, but the cultivation of the wisdom is gradual. And the Buddha says this too. He says, just as the great ocean gradually shelves, slopes, and inclines, there's no sudden precipice. So also in this Dharma, there's a gradual training, a gradual course, a gradual progression. And there's no sudden penetration to final knowledge. So when I'm chasing that moment where one day everything's going to finally change and click into place, the Buddha's saying, give up on that. These small moments of awakening, are you there for them? Are you present for them? To demystify awakening as a sudden event, and to realize whatever you practice, you get better at. And we're always practicing something. That, I feel like, is another principle of Buddhism. Every moment, whether you're conscious, whether you're mindful or not, something's being practiced. This is what we call karma. Something's being followed or enacted or felt or reacted to or responded to, met with kindness or met with something else. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, liberation is the inevitable fruit of the path and is bound to blossom forth when there's steady and persistent practice. The only requisites for reaching the final goal are two: to start and to continue. If these requirements are met, there's no doubt the goal will be attained. I got kind of emotional when I was reading that, because sometimes I just feel like I'm not doing enough, you know? I think there's a Jonathan Foer like poem or something where he says, sometimes I can hear my bones cracking under the weight of all the lives I'm not living. You know, I always have this sense of feeling like I'm not enough. I'm not doing enough. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is just saying, all you have to do is start and to continue. You know, one of our meditation teachers early on gave this loving kindness phrase. It's actually a forgiveness phrase. Of, I love you, keep going. I love you, keep going. To just keep going. And a lot of times when, you know, I feel like I need to be better, or I'm so far lost or gone that I'm beyond repair and broken. You know, all I never ever needed to hear from someone is, well, do you think you could just keep going? You don't need to be fixed. You don't need to be anything other than where you're at right now. But can you just wake up tomorrow and try again? And y'all, for real, like, that's been my life for years of my life, has been waking up and just getting through that next day. And if I fail to see that as probably the most important thing I could have ever done, I'm missing the mark on where my awakening's coming from. You know, I remember, like, doing the dishes when I was depressed and being like, okay, I can be good with that today, you know? And I'm grateful for my friends, because I managed to be around people that are also broken, you know, and that had no choice but to it to be the bind that tied us and bonded us together. You know, I have very little tolerance for small talk these days. You know, because I know that underneath that facade, for me and for so many other, a lot of people are suffering and struggling. And just remember that, you know, when we lash out or when we judge people or whatever, they're struggling. Even the people we hate, they may be struggling so bad that they're completely lost in it. And that's why they are this person you hate. Can you imagine that level of pain and suffering? So we, you know, the eternal law is hatred doesn't cease by hatred, but by love alone is healed. And we develop that love gradually. In the beginning, for me, it was just, can I hate myself less? And I got permission from my teachers, you know, when we were doing self-compassion. And I loved this about the Against the Stream community. This is why it was such a home for me. Is because when I heard teachers talking about self-compassion and self-love, I was like, not in here. You know, I was serious. I was like, that doesn't exist for me. And this is so isolating for me to come in here and hear you talk about love and light and loving yourself, because that's not my experience. And my teacher said, well, can you hate yourself less? And I was like, fuck, yeah, I think I need to start hating myself a little bit less. Which was a huge act of self-love. Go figure, right? I just had to start to figure out what self-love looked like. That's what my problem was. Because self-love isn't an emotion, it's a behavior. And that's the thing that I always thought. I thought there was this feeling and this experience that everyone else was having that I was somehow just right outside of. And then, you know, through Buddhism, I learned, like, self-love is not a feeling, you know, it's an action. And yeah, maybe it's just like when you're noticing that you're beating up on yourself, driving down the road, just be like, yo, dude, cut that shit out. You're like not that bad. Not even I love you or you're that great. Because in the beginning, I was kind of bad, you know what I mean? So I couldn't lie to myself. I was like, I'm not that bad. Awakening is ultimately, and this is speaking to, you know, maybe the more unknown elements of where the path could lead us. Awakening is a way of seeing. It's a radical shift in perspective of where our happiness lies. Our happiness isn't dependent on the conditions of our lives. It's not dependent on what's happening to you. It's not depending on who you are. Who you are is just a thought and a narrative and a story that your thinking mind came up with anyway. So your happiness can't be dependent on your self-image, because it's constructed by your own mind. Your happiness can't be dependent on getting what you want, because what you want is temporary, and what you want isn't always fulfilling the promise of what you want anyway. Our happiness depends on how we relate to, how we show up for each moment, not the moment itself. Peace has to exist beyond aligning everything to a comfortable level. Peace has to be amidst discomfort. You know, and Sharon Salzberg says, we can travel a long way and do many different things, but our deepest happiness is not born from accumulating new experiences. It's born from letting go of what is unnecessary and knowing ourselves to be always at home. True happiness may not be all that far away, but it requires a radical change of view as to where to find it. These are the Buddha's words after his awakening, and we'll open it up for some discussion. He said, through many a birth I've wandered in this world, seeking in vain the builder of this house. Unfulfilling it is to be born again and again. O housemaker, now I've seen you. You shall build no more houses for me. He's talking about reactivity. Your beams are broken, your ridgepole shattered. My mind is free from all past conditionings and craves the future no longer.